This is the Climb to Space.
Hello and welcome to the Decline to State Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Decline to State is proud to bring you on a surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. You can find us on the web at declinefm.com, where you will find a link to the live chat. The live chat is your go-to way to interact with other listeners and bring up points for discussion on the show. Today is a pre-record episode. We are speaking to you from Saturday afternoon or morning, so we won't be able to relay your questions, but that shouldn't stop you from spamming the chat room. I am Ronald McPaul, your beacon of freedom in the heart of the Silicon Valley, and I'm joined by my handsome co-casters. Now let them go around the horn and introduce themselves.
Hi guys, this is Eternal. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ron. This is Toast.
You got it. And today we are speaking with a fortunate guest. We missed him just last week, but we're glad to have him on. It's Kevin Carson, a popular blogger. C4SS, I think, is a page that you're on. And might consider himself a mutualist, as well as a free market anti-capitalist. So welcome, Kevin. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you start off, tell us a little bit about maybe what writers or philosophers most strongly influenced your thinking.
Okay, originally the brand of mutualism or individualist anarchism I was attracted to came from Benjamin Tucker. I guess he was my first introduction to it, and I pretty quickly after that came across Thomas Hodgkin in England. He's conventionally classed as one of the early Ricardian socialists, but he actually based his thought more on Smith and Ricardo. He was a radical classical liberal critic of the capitalism of his day, and also Franz Oppenheimer, author of The State, who saw the central role of the state in enforcing monopoly as the main source of rent extraction in society. From that point on, I've gradually moved into analysis, I guess you could broadly call techno-utopian. I've got more interested in network organization, the open culture movement.
Have you followed any, I know Eternal and I were speaking on it recently, that the company Steam, with the famous or the illustrious Gabe Newell, I guess some people describe that the organization of their company as being kind of a mutualist approach, but he's got a whole bunch of new ideas about, you know, I think it's similar to what you're saying, that it's kind of perhaps a technocratic way of running things, but definitely not conventional, and definitely a lot of profit moving around and sharing, and it's kind of breaks paradigms, but it's still very successful.
Right, non-hierarchical.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of that since the first hints of the possibility of the web in the 90s. Writers like Tom Peters, for example, talking about flattening hierarchies and trying to replicate the network.
Is he a blogger too? Tom Peters? Is he a blogger too?
He's the guy that wrote a bunch of the management theory books back in the 90s. His first book was In Search of Excellence back in the early 80s.
Okay, great. Yeah, thanks for filling me in. Kind of probably not as well read on a lot of these names as you. I have, you mentioned Ricardo earlier. I know it's like was it 19th or 18th century economist?
Early 19th century. He was like one of the main classical political economists alongside Smith and Mill.
Yeah,
he basically, one of the big ones. So Ricardo basically started and put together a lot of the basics for modern economics, you know, classical economics.
Probably the most systematic of the classical political economists.
still used all the time today, his stuff.
Yeah, although, you know, there's a big debate over whether the marginalists made him obsolete. That's actually one of the fights I got into the middle of early in my writing career. But
when you say marginalists, you're referring to
Jevons, Walraw, Menger.
And is this referring to the actual act of referring to like something on the margin, or like that point of utility on where? Like,
yeah,
like
the whole theory of marginal utility economics. It's the basis of both Austrianism and neoclassical economics, the dominant paradigm.
And for our less economically well-read listeners, I guess the best way to describe marginal utility theory is that every new...
You're breaking up on me here.
Oh, sorry about that. So every new item, every new unit that you get produces less utility of the same thing.
And the price of a good or service is determined by the subjective utility of the last or marginal item produced. It was originally seen as kind of a big ideological blow against Ricardo and the labor theory of value.
And that's when the marginalists came in and kind of, you said, made him almost obsolete. That's interesting.
Well, he's arguably, he's argued to have made it obsolete. I argued the contrary.
Did you get into a little online battle in this?
Well, this was my first book, Studies in Mutualist Political Economy. The first third of the book was just on economic theory and an attempt to rehabilitate the classical political economists and the labor theory of value. To put it briefly, my argument was that the idea that marginalism had disproved the labor theory was based on a straw man interpretation of both, and I see them more as complementary than adversarial.
Interesting. Very interesting.
I see marginalism more as a mechanism that describes how the classical law of value operated, provided a subjective mechanism for it, really, when it replaced it.
Doesn't sound like a small undertaking at all to put yourself out there, do a first portion of a book to kind of, you know, keep pushing forward what you appear to be believe to be the noble cause. I mean, that's that's impressive.
Well, thanks. I had fun writing it.
Certainly. Many of our listeners are going to be of the persuasion that, in fact, they're going to be more fervently Austrian, I suppose, than...
Not all of them, but yeah, you're probably right. Maybe
right,
more
so
later.
I just think that, you know, in the spirit of being better read, that's probably an argument that Austrians who listen to our show should expose themselves to.
Well, I've got a lot of Austrian friends at C4SS, a lot of especially left-wing supporters of Rothbard and so forth. So.
Oh, very cool. That's a good mix.
We've had some interesting discussions in this.
I want to ask a little bit about, so you come from a little bit of a different economic point of view, but still reach some similar conclusions on 99% of things that the traditional anarcho-capitalist Rothbardian type person reaches. How exactly does your labor theory of value meshing with the marginal utility theory, your interpretation of that, lead towards the ultimate conclusion that the state is really bad?
Well, as I see it, and as Tucker and the Boston anarchists saw it, the natural tendency of the free market price system is for labor to receive its full product, and the main function of the state is to intervene in the economy on behalf of capitalists and landlords and enforce artificial scarcities of land and capital so that their owners can extract artificial scarcity rents from them. It artificially reduces the marginal returns on labor compared to those on land and capital, and reduces the bargaining power of labor so that you have an overall economy where workers are competing for employment opportunities instead of the other way around. And if you abolish all of the state's monopolies, like state enforcement of title to vacant and unimproved lands, market entry barriers and bank licensing for the cooperative supply of credit, copyrights, patents, and so forth, it would radically shift the bargaining power of labor so that capital and land would be much more readily available at a lower price, and employers would have to be competing much more vigorously with opportunities for self-employment. So the labor market would be a seller's market instead of a buyer's market. Benjamin Tucker wrote a great essay called State Socialism and Anarchism, where he classified anarchism as the non-state branch of the classical socialist movement, and argued that the best, unlike Marx, he believed that the best way to achieve full socialism was through the closest possible approximation to a free market.
I could get behind a lot, if not all of that. Hopefully on the same vein, Kevin, there was a quote from one of your articles that I was reading when I was, prepping for this podcast, that caught my attention and I kind of enjoyed. I think towards the end of it, you were saying that as a genuine free market libertarian, I want labor to receive the full value of its product without paying tribute to big landlords and usurers or the holders of artificial quote-unquote property rights like patents, copyrights, and licenses. I want the prices of goods and services to be driven by competition down to the real cost of supplying them without state-enforced artificial scarcities to enclose technical progress as a source of rights. I want the average work week to reflect the actual time required to produce our standard of living without the monkey of renters and subsidized waste on our backs. So I think that was one of your close to the closing paragraphs, but I think it sounds related to what you're saying now, and I thought it kind
yeah,
of gets
yeah,
to the
very
point.
Very much so. Very much so. I think if you eliminated all of the embedded rents that we're paying to privileged classes and all the embedded cost of planned obsolescence and subsidized waste and so forth, probably take a 10 or 15 hour work week on average to support our current quality of life. And that ties
right
in with a lot of utopian socialist visions, Marx talking about in the full communist society. You've got the guy that can hunt and fish in the morning and herd cattle in the afternoon and criticize literature after dinner without ever being a hunter or a fisherman or critic. Ken McLeod says that sounds a lot like the science fiction author. Ken McLeod said that sounds a lot like the crofters in Scotland who still have legal title to their old crofts. They still actually possess something of their original land tenure rights, unlike a lot of the other victims of an enclosure. So they've got that base of economic independence where they can take work or leave it on based on their own needs. They're able to schedule their own time and be jacks of all trades if they feel like it. And it's also, if you go back to the late medieval times, before all the massive land expropriations of the peasantry, before the enclosures of the open field and the seizure of common pasture land and so forth, when soil fertility was high and rents and taxes were low, it typically took about an average of 20 hours of labor a week year-round for a peasant family to support itself. And the whole reason for the modern state, from the first rise of the absolute state, the destruction of the free towns in Europe, and the expropriation of peasant lands, was to destroy the state of affairs so that the majority of people would be working twice as long in order to support a ruling class in addition to themselves.
So you mentioned the enclosure movement as being part of the negative aspects of states that I would say have driven both the Marxist theories as well as the anarchist, individualist anarchist theories really heavily into existence in the first place.
Yeah, and the early working class movement and socialist movements came out of many of the same Enlightenment ideological currents as classical liberalism did. You can see that radical side in Adam Smith, where he's condemning the big landlords for, in biblical terms, reaping where they didn't sow, and that sort of thing. A major part of the wealth of nations is its criticism of mercantilism, the merchant classes in alliance with the state, and the big landlords in alliance with the state, and in defense of free enterprise by the little guys against those structural legacies of the medieval world.
So, I guess one of the big questions we have, especially being part of the Reddit community, where socialism, state socialism, and social democracy are like basically objects of worship, how do we reach people who seem to understand at least that there's something wrong with the idea of privilege and power and stuff, but use government as the solution to it? How do we get them to understand that government is not the solution?
Well, if you look at the actual government forms of socialism, so-called, as they've been implemented, they're either the Soviet model of full-blown state socialism, which essentially replaces capitalism with the state bureaucracy as the new capitalists, and the wage system supporting them in a position of privilege. And on the other hand, the European model of social democracy, while, I'll be the first to admit that it's more comfortable for the average person than the Reagan-Thatcher model of so-called free enterprise. If I had to choose between the two, I'd probably rather be living in Germany than some place like Tom DeLay's vision of the Marianas Islands. But it's still a version of capitalism, and it's run primarily in the long-run interests of capitalists in having a system that's stable and sustainable, and where they won't get their throats cut. German-style social democracy is just a liberal version of capitalism, where they try to overcome the boom-bust cycle by giving labor a somewhat larger share of its product than it gets here. But the ultimate goal is not justice to labor. The ultimate goal is to remove the destabilizing tendencies so that they can have the largest possible sustainable long-term extraction of profit without the danger of revolution or depression.
Right. So, a lot of our listeners call themselves voluntarists, and that's certainly, I guess, a new sort of libertarian movement in my lifetime. And one of my problems, I guess, maybe with the main line of thinking that voluntarists seem to use is that, how voluntary an interaction is with a person is sort of the prism through which they view all human interaction, and therefore, because the government doesn't have a legitimate claim to the property that they say they have and the actions which they take, therefore the government is illegitimate and whatever. And at the same time, one of the holes I see in their thinking is that when a person, I guess, you know, applies for a job or whatever that happens to be, that is, in fact, not really a voluntary interaction because there's this element of force. They are forced to work in order to, you know, maintain, to eat and to raise a family and so on. And do you agree?
Yeah, I do. That's been, like, one of the main themes I write about. It's not really voluntary in the sense of being a free market transaction. It's immediately voluntary in the sense that the employer is not coercing the employee to accept the job, but it takes place within a larger coercive framework where the state has tilted the playing field in the direction of the employer and against the worker and reduced the bargaining power of labor. So, you know, if I had gone to look for a job during the Volcker recession, the individual employer might not have been culpable for the terms of employment. But you look at the actual motivation of Volcker and the Federal Reserve, they explicitly see the high bargaining power of labor as a proxy for inflationary pressure. They don't want unemployment to get too low because they think that will put inflationary pressure on the economy. So when unemployment gets too low and wages start creeping too high, they will raise the interest rates a few percent in order to throw several million people out of work, and the bosses can point to the unemployment lines and say, hey, you should just be grateful you've got a job. And that's not direct coercion by the employer, but it's a rent the employer is able to collect by virtue of living within a coercive framework.
So we often, you mentioned the Fed, and we often hear about, these days interest rates way too low, creating artificial booms and bubbles and such, but I haven't really heard that, the flip side of that, which is when interest rates are set too high, what you end up getting is a shift of bargaining power away from the sellers of labor to the buyers of labor. It's an interesting take that I think we kind of are at least not highly aware of right now just because of what the Fed is doing currently. But
yeah, it's
it
not
is
a line of thinking
point.
You often hear on, at least on Reddit.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, there's certainly something I'd say complementary between the hard money view of money being too cheap and the individualist anarchist view of it being too expensive, because it is too cheap for the people who create it. You've got a system under the Federal Reserve's bank cartel where the government has delegated the right to create the money supply to a system of state licensed banks, and they can basically lend money into existence at interest when it has no opportunity cost, no marginal cost for them whatsoever to supply it. If the Federal Reserve changes its reserve requirements, or their open market operations suddenly put much larger reserves into the bank's deposits, that's just out of thin air creating trillions of dollars that the banks are suddenly authorized to lend into existence without getting it from anywhere else. They're just creating money out of thin air at no cost to themselves and then collecting interest on it. So it's too cheap for them, but they're in the position of a monopolist where they're the ones who control the spigot. They have a monopoly on the issuance of money. So the people they lend it to, they can charge, you know, enormous rents on it based on their position. I don't see the two as really being at odds. Although, you know, I do disagree with the idea that interest rates in the economy at large are too low. The problem's not cheap money per se. It's the problem is with the overall corporate economic system within which the cheap money exists.
It's definitely not when they make more of it, it's not balanced around the economy, that's for sure.
Yeah. You're breaking up again here. I don't know.
It might be just your end. I'm hearing him okay.
It might be.
So.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I was hearing him loud.
Well, I can hear you through the breaking up. It just.
Okay. In either case, I'll make sure to speak into the mic. Let me know if we're having trouble. But one thing we touched upon, or you touched upon a couple of times, and I think you have a fair and good point of perspective, and I like the discussion about the work week being way longer than it potentially would need to be to accomplish the same things. It made me think of a book I read by an author, Tim Ferriss. It's kind of been popular the last couple of years. I think the 4-hour work week, and it's kind of a marketing gimmick, and he's good at marketing things to say that, okay, 4 hours could be what your goal, and that's kind of what he's driving at. But I mean, there's also a lot of legitimacy to that, regardless if he knows, you know, some of these economic names and theories behind it that we're talking about, and unlike the, you know, as Toast mentioned, the, you know, federal level of distributing money and stuff, like, he's probably not going to get into that, but there is a lot of, it's very intriguing, and it's obviously something that, you know, some people have interest in, to have the freedom to have a shorter yeah. work week.
Well, that's just a vision that's had a lot of resonance with people going all the way back to early modern folklore about Big Rock Candy Mountain or the land of cocaine or whatever. I've got a pamphlet laying around here somewhere by the Wobbly called 4-Hour Day, 4-Day Week. And one of the things Kropotkin, his main line of argument in the conquest of bread, was that the newly achieved productivity of labor meant that if production was organized efficiently on a decentralized basis, taking advantage of the new possibilities of electrical power, and all of the rents they were paying to the ruling class were eliminated and so forth, he calculated how many hours of labor it would take per year to produce the average family's shelter, clothing, food, and so forth. And he came up with this very appealing vision of people just, you know, working a few hours a day and then spending the rest of their time in leisure and artistic creation and so on, and social solidarity activities with their neighbors.
Yeah, it's not something that gets brought up that much in common capitalist parlance. It's like, you figure, I guess it's assumed a lot that you're going to work that full amount of time but then get more and more money. And, you know, there's another option, I guess, which is worth mentioning, but you could just work
yeah.
less and engage in society more.
In a way, it's almost like an ideological shibboleth on a lot of the libertarian right, is, you know, to deny there would be a reduced work time on average. They get a lot of mileage out of the so-called lump of labor fallacy and argue that effective demand is for all intents and purposes infinite, and the more you increase productivity, the more stuff people will buy. And I just don't see it. At some point, people treat leisure as a consumer good. That's why the average work week is 40 hours now instead of 80 or 100 like it was in the 19th century. And the general tendency of technological progress is towards radical deflation in prices. There's a guy named Jed, I can't remember his last name, who has a blog called Anomalous Presumptions, but he's done some great analysis on this, and the one thing he pointed to was Encyclopedia Britannica. If you look back in the 80s, when the average middle-class person probably had a set of Britannica that cost them more than $1,000, the first thing Microsoft comes along with Encarta, which is still, you know, fairly expensive, you know, a couple hundred dollars because it's proprietary, but it's still an order of magnitude reduction in cost for essentially the same kind of good. So you're talking about a tenfold reduction in the labor hours required for the equivalent of a Britannica. And that put a huge dent in Britannica's sales, and it only lasted a few years because Wikipedia came along and destroyed Encarta. And so you've got, why in the world, unless somebody's just rich and has money to burn, why in the world would they buy a set of Britannica now when you can just go online to Wikipedia and get a very serviceable encyclopedia with the same level of detail in most of the articles?
Yeah, and even before the time of the internet, there was psychology that showed that people would almost always choose leisure activity over extra work if their basic needs were already met.
Yeah. Also, the same thing applies to micromanufacturing. If you look at the open source hardware they're coming up with, the tabletop CNC machine tools that are being developed in places like Open Source Ecology and by the hackerspace movement. Typically, an open source garage 3D printer or cutting table or router or whatever costs probably less than 10% of what their commercial equivalents cost. And those commercial CNC tools that came out in the 80s were themselves a tenfold cost reduction in the older mass production machinery. So you're talking about a garage factory with maybe 10K worth of tabletop machine tools being able to produce the same quality of goods that used to require a $1 million mass production factory. And 10K, that's a few months' wage for a skilled blue-collar worker. That's basically a return to the state of affairs before the Industrial Revolution, when most production was undertaken with individually affordable, general-purpose craft tools rather than specialized mass production machinery. And that's destroying the whole basis for the factory system and the wage system. The whole reason the factory system came into existence was that the machinery was so expensive that only a consortium of rich people could buy it and then hire other people to work it for them. Marcin Jakubowski at Open Source Ecology framed it like this: when a worker can own his own factory for six months wages, how are you going to keep him down in the factory?
So we actually just had a poster on the anarcho-capitalism subreddit. He posted a picture of, I guess it's like a laser cutter that he just got. He said, "It's my first piece of capital," and we're all cheering him on. It's pretty cool what you can get nowadays to just put it in your garage and go and build whatever. The machinery is so versatile because of digital technology now.
And one of the central things the state does right now is to stave off this radical deflationary pressure and the horrible, horrible threat of workers being able to own their own means of production and control the circumstances of production. That's the main thing patent law does. They're already talking about putting DRM in micromanufacturing machinery so that they won't be able to use proprietary design files, because otherwise, you know, the danger is people would go to the Pirate Bay and get pirated CAD files and download them and use their garage machinery to produce knockoffs of proprietary goods without the 90% of their price that's an embedded rent on patents.
So I don't know if... sorry to interrupt. I don't know if you're part of, like, the gaming scene at all, or if you're familiar with
I know a lot of gamers, but I never got into it.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, the EA and some of these other big companies wanted tons of DRM and all their stuff. And
yeah,
it only hurts them in the marketplace, for one. And then everyone breaks it anyway. Like, it unless you have to actively... So what they did is they made it... I think you had to, like, connect directly to their servers, have an internet connection just to play the game at all. Which you can still pull. And it definitely, you know, made it such that everyone just threw up their hands and said, we're just not going to buy your product if you're going to do that. So
yeah, that's one reason iTunes stopped using DRM. They pretty much just put an end to it. You know, they're trying to do an end run around that with legislation like SOPA and all that, but Cory Doctorow said the desktop computer is a machine for copying bits, and if your business model depends on stopping people from copying bits, you're going to fail.
Yeah, ultimately, I think one of the shining rays of hope in the whole DRM business is that it seems that the business models that aren't employing strict DRM seem to be the ones that are winning out, because ultimately, it's the ones that are providing a very good service, whether that's Steam or, you know, iTunes is improving their service by not having DRM. That at least it seems to be tending towards something that benefits consumers.
Yeah, and it's really not hurting, you know, despite all the RIA propaganda, it's really not hurting artists. Mike Masnick at Tech Dirt shows a lot of studies that indicate, you know, the music industry as a whole is taking a pretty large hit in terms of total revenues because of file sharing. But the actual income of individual artists is going down very little, if any, at all. The entire hit is going to the distribution infrastructure and to the profits of the record companies, the middlemen, and so on. So we're, you know, the main effect of all these different kinds of radical deflation from technological process is to leave in place the 10% of price that actually remunerates the producer, and to destroy the 90% of price, just an artificial scarcity rent going to the people who keep the toll gates.
So I wanted to backtrack. I want to get back to this stuff in a bit, but I do want to backtrack to something because I've been meaning to weigh in on it, which is you brought up the 40-hour work week a few minutes ago, and I wanted to talk about the dangers of government getting involved in setting, trying to fix a problem the government created, which is to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, they legislate this 40-hour work week, and then it becomes this kind of staple where everything starts getting attached to it, so you have that being the full-time position with benefits getting attached to everything. And nowadays, nobody wants to hire full-time because it costs, double what it does to hire a person for 39 hours, which makes no sense.
Yeah, and it's that's another drawback of the whole social democratic or New Deal model, is that you have an economy where your entire life is organized around the employer. The employer is guaranteed a profit by the state in return for, and guaranteed stable market share without the danger of price wars, in return for supplying a social safety net to the employee, so you wind up with a form of industrial serfdom.
And I certainly think that these days, it's weird that people have this lust for the full-time position. They hate the idea of having a part-time position, not because they don't want to work 40 hours, but because they want all these benefits that come attached to it. So it's like a step into, like, bizarro land where everybody's fighting to have something they don't want.
Yeah, that's the other thing about the 40-hour work week. It was originally set back in the 1930s when productivity per worker was probably about a third of what it is now. And it's never come down. And you see all these scare pieces about technological unemployment. And the problem isn't a reduced amount of work. The problem is to get the product of that work. The, you know, if prices were actually reduced by the same amount that productivity has reduced the cost of production, and all those productivity benefits were distributed among workers by market competition instead of being monopolized by the owners of intellectual property, and the remaining amount of available work was evenly distributed through a lower work week, it would be a utopia. The problem is that because of all of these monopolies, the productivity is enclosed as a source of rent, and all of that increased output per worker in a reduced amount of time is being skimmed off by the top by the people who control the toll gates. So the worker still has to work 40 hours to get a sufficient amount of income to live on, even though they're producing several times as much, and it all just goes to the rentier classes in the form of increased savings and investment capital they're sitting on with nowhere to put it, which, you know, in turn leads to worsening problems of boom-bust cycles and overinvestment and underconsumption and all those other problems of 20th century capitalism. And if all the income actually went to the people who produced the value and their amount of labor was regulated by their own consumption needs, there wouldn't be a problem of overproduction.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned just there, it seems to be that there's such a common meme, I guess, maybe in political discourse, that everyone needs a job, that work is somehow the end in this process, and somehow people care more about every single person just working that 40-hour week or whatever,
yeah,
without even considering that, well, no, we just want people to have their needs met or to make a living, whatever that happens to be.
Yeah, yeah, from your mouth to God's ear. That's that obsession with jobs, jobs, jobs you hear from so much of the, you know, liberal establishment and, you know, from the right establishment for that matter. Yeah, there you go. Gerbs. And the whole idea of the job is about, you know, at most 250, 300 years old, going back to the time where the landed classes in England said, hey, you know, we'll evict all these cottagers from their common rights to the fen and the forest and to the common pasture and so forth, so that they can't just lay about like a bunch of bums and work when they feel like it. And then we'll give them jobs as agricultural laborers working for us, you know, because their only alternative will be to starve, right? You know, what could be the downside of that for, I mean, for us, obviously not for them. Since then, the job has been conflated with the idea of work or livelihood. There's a passage in Alfred J. Knox's book, Our Enemy, the State, where he talks about just the utter perversity of the obsession in national politics with jobs and with giving people work, with the basic idea of work as something that you're given rather than something you do. In an economy where there were 10 million people out of jobs and there were hundreds of millions of idle acres of vacant land full of resources for the using that those idle workers could apply their labor directly to. And the idea that they had to sit around and wait for someone in the owning classes to give them work instead of just occupying the land and feeding themselves on it, it's something we're conditioned not to see.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned it a couple of times that it sounds like it's a good take home as far as a main book that kind of inspires you or you take a lot from. What was the name and author of that one that you just referenced?
Oh, Our Enemy, the State, by Nock.
Okay, great, great. Yeah, I just want to make sure that our listeners got that down.
That's sitting on my Kindle. I haven't gotten to it yet.
There's few on that Kindle nowadays. We thought you might get a kick out of this, Kevin. There was we had a guest late last year, Arini, who has a YouTube channel, and I don't think he did the video, but on his channel, and I posted it to our Decline State, our show subreddit. He had a 5-minute video just on how to appear productive at work, or how to, and the
face
whole thing,
time.
Yeah, the whole thing was premised on the fact that, okay, so your employer is going to be able to know what websites you're going to, but they're going to think that an Excel spreadsheet and a word processor are busy, but the main thing is they have no idea with current technology how efficient or fast you can be at work. So you're gonna need these skills. So let's go at it. And you just talk about how to look.
It sounds almost like the same kind of stuff the crypto anarchist movement comes up with to thwart surveillance by the state trying to keep track of what people are doing, which says a lot about the atmosphere you experience at work.
Oh
where,
yeah,
you know, you go from supposedly being protected by the Bill of Rights and all that stuff and being a free sovereign citizen and blah blah bling bling to punching that clock, you know, after you walk through the doors that say abandon all hope ye who enter here, and instead you've got the poster of Big Brother watching you all over everything.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because recently I've been, I do have a 40-hour work week job, and I try not to do too much more than that if possible. And it's, walking around in there, it feels like, to a degree, like the same paradigm as public schools were, which, in turn feels similar to the same paradigm that prisons are. It just seems like a, you're on lockdown, kind of like you're saying, not the best environment.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, in the external society, the state tries to conceal or downplay the whole Big Brother aspect of things so that you don't notice it as much, and you hear all the propaganda about our freedoms and everything. But you go into the workplace, and they have actually celebrate the surveillance. They have no need to throw off the protective cloak.
Lack of privacy equals safety.
Yeah.
You shouldn't complain about it if you got nothing to hide.
You can get out.
Uh-huh.
You can go to Somalia, which is the channel below this one.
Yeah, I knew a guy. He used to at his previous jobs, he'd bring in thumb drives that had built-in encrypted routers in them and everything, so that you could just plug them into the hard drive at work.
Okay,
and
it's like
bypass
a software VPN?
All of that stuff, yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, so I got a feeling there's going to be an increased market for that sort of thing.
This was, again, wireless internet via USB that you can sign into in the
computer? Yeah, I mean, he was just, telling me about how he used to distribute them at work at a previous job. It was just a little USB thumb drive that had the encrypted router built into it that you could plug that in at work and bypass all the employer restrictions.
It sounds like it's a software VPN or virtual private network.
Yeah, I don't have the geek cred to tell you. Unfortunately, he doesn't work there anymore. He had a horrible attitude towards authority, and the funny thing is, he was a Fox News Republican.
Oh,
when it came to national
makes so much
politics.
Sense.
Yeah, when it came to national politics, he'd come in there telling me, all those polls are overcounting the Democratic voters, and Romney's going to win by a landslide, and all this stuff, and just basically repeating all the Fox News talking points. But when it came to dealing with the employer and using his cyber geek knowledge to thwart authority and so forth, it was just... It's sort of the same dichotomy you see in Eric S. Raymond, I guess.
Seems almost like a non sequitur, having that attitude towards authority when it's right up in your face, and then with regards to national politics, just not being having that universal trait. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's the same thing as the people on MSNBC running all the critical stories about the Bush police state and indefinite detention and everything. And,
I'm glad the police state stopped as soon as Obama got elected.
Oh, yeah, just the other day, Crystal Ball was on one of those MSNBC talking head shows and saying that, you know, if it was Bush in there, she wouldn't trust him with the authority to use the drones, but she felt comfortable with Obama having it because he was a much more balanced and reasonable
right, it's really wise and stuff, yeah.
Which, I mean, in a way, it's scarier because with Bush, it was tied up entirely with a personality cult of him and Cheney and all those other PNAC neocons that just basically had a hard-on for police statism and were champing at the bits to expand executive authority out of just fascistic personal temperament. And with Obama, it's more just like creeping bureaucratic Caesarism, achieving essentially the same thing. With, you know, Obama is, I don't think he's personally got the same lust for SS Nazi chic and all that the Bush people did, but as reluctantly and sorrowfully as it may be, he's just basically ratcheting everything they did up tenfold and saying, well, we have to do this because it's for our safety. And it's really scarier when it's done by someone that's seems halfway likable than it is when it's coming from someone that everyone hates.
You can only be kept in the prison that you refuse to see.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wanted to hit on a couple of things. So, just in advance, we'll have one final segment at the end we call Bizarre Mode. But before we get to that, we're going... I wanted to talk really quick about firm structure in a free society and just weigh in a little bit on my experiences. This is a company I work for. Not giving too much away, we have I would call it a flat organization. I mean, we all kind of do our own thing. It's an engineering company, so we all just go off and engineer our own things and work together if it becomes necessary. But it's not hierarchical and it's very flexible too. A lot of work, you can work from home and stuff and work flexible hours and stuff. And people seem a lot happier to go and really take charge of their own little project, just like they do at Valve, which is, you know, they have no real hierarchy, and it's like, well, if you want to do a project, then you can take lead on it and have pull other people in and stuff, but it's a lot of work. Everyone's really excited for that. There's a lot of autonomy and self-governance within the organization, and it seems to really help. I find that. So I did an internship a couple of years ago where it was, you know, the clock in, clock out type thing. God, that was boring. I wasted a lot of time. This is very different than that, and I see the way, you know, Valve or my company is organized is the way companies should be organized.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is getting back to the whole thing about Tom Peters and Steam and all that. There's a concept in Lewis Mumford's writing in his History of Technology where he calls it the cultural pseudomorph. And he gets pseudomorph from geology. It refers to a situation where just through osmosis all these mineral deposits replace the original organism to form a fossil, like you're pouring them into a mold created by the original structure and just replacing it with new content. And he argues that the existing power structures tend to co-opt the potential of new forms of technology, so that instead of it realizing its full potential into a society that's totally organized around its benefits, you have its benefits on a limited basis being incorporated into older power structures, like putting new wine in old bottles. And we see a lot of this in the long-term transition from hierarchy to networks. originally see hierarchies becoming increasingly hollowed out and trying to stave off their own collapse by incorporating elements of networks in turn. And that's the kind of thing Tom Peters described, the Nike model of outsourcing everything to small independent job shops that are essentially garage factories, but leaving the corporate framework in place with the corporate headquarters controlling marketing and finance and intellectual property so that they could use the productivity of the new technology while continuing to extract rents from it within the pre-existing framework. And you see the same thing with the military and its fourth generational warfare doctrines, where they're trying to duplicate the agility and resilience of networked resistance movements like Al-Qaeda, but to co-opt it within the old command and structure of state militaries. And these things are somewhat more efficient than their hierarchical predecessors, but they're not as efficient as the real thing. And I think in the end, it's impossible to realize the full productivity potential of the new networked organization and the new technologies, because they will always be hindered by interference from the top within these hierarchies. No matter how much the management theory talks about flattening hierarchies and things being horizontally organized, there will always be middle managers who come up with some way to screw it up or interfere. There's an article on fourth generation warfare doctrine where they were talking about the way it was actually applied in Afghanistan. And the original doctrine, you know, was brilliant, the way it came out of the Army War College and the service academies, where they developed it. The idea was to take advantage of new network communications technologies so that tactical units would have the same kind of agility that Al-Qaeda cells have. These tactical units and their commanders would be empowered by network communications and their independent access to intelligence and so forth to act autonomously without waiting for orders from above. The problem is that the military bureaucracy, the field grade officers and above, saw the potential of this network communications and said instead, this enables us to require the tactical commander to have 30 dotted line sign-offs instead of just 3. So you actually have all of these new potential for communication being absorbed by the tactical commander having to communicate with 10 times as many people to get approval to do anything. And you have companies being delayed by three days to do the most basic things in response to their own direct intelligence, by which point Al-Qaeda's already moved on. They have to get sign-offs from brigade-level commands just to do things like distribute propaganda or open up a school or something in a village. And I think you see the same thing in the corporate world. Bill Gates tried to do that within Microsoft, creating that hacker Silicon Valley startup culture of people coming in at whatever the hour they felt like and sitting around in their stocking feed and having time for their own projects and everything. But
there have been a handful of attempts to try to do away with it.
But how do they compare to the genuine thing like a Linux developer group? They're just doing a half-assed job of recreating internally what exists by nature on the outside.
Right. And also the pseudomorph, that mechanism you described earlier, that process whereby you one thing replaces the other. It's kind of, it's like a status waffle iron is what it made me think of.
Yeah. What was that Grandpa Simpson said? We invented the fax machine 50 years ago out of a waffle iron and telephone.
That was back in 1952.
Yeah. I had a yellow onion on my belt.
The Kaiser stole my work. It's funny. So on that note of silliness, we had one last segment that Eternal hinted at earlier, too, and we call it Bizarro Mode. Now that you mentioned, I think Abe Simpson would enjoy it. But if you'll indulge us, and if you can think of it on the spot, I know you've been engaged in this with thoughtful discussion for a while. But if you can think of some view that you hold dear, and then debate against it. What's like the, you know, you hear a commenter on your blog or some person you discuss with who kind of makes you cringe because you're not ready to debate or you don't want that point of view?
Oh, the main thing I get, and it comes especially from establishment managerial liberal
types. And also, if you want to do it in first person mode, it can sometimes be funnier.
Economies of scale. You don't understand the importance of economies of scale. All this hippy-dippy Ralph Borsodi decentralist stuff. You think you can produce a car in your garage? It requires big, large-scale mass production industry with lots of bureaucracy to do these things because, you know, as regrettable as it is, it takes bureaucracies with standard operating procedures and Weberian work rules and people behind desks within and out boxes to control the scale of production it takes to do some things like, microchip fabbing and producing cars with V8 engines and, you know, trains and jumbo jets, and you're just living in a hippie dream world of cyber utopian adolescence if you think that you can have an economy without grown-ups in charge.
Very nice.
That's pretty good. That was pretty good.
Yeah, these people, they act like nobody's ever heard of economy of scale before they bring it up. It's almost like the creationist used the second law of thermodynamics.
Yeah, checkmate, atheists.
Great, everyone.
Don't you know evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics? And here's like Dawkins saying, huh, the what? You know, second law of thermodynamics. Egad, this stands everything I ever believed on its head. Oh my God, you know.
This argument was so stupid I wasn't prepared for it.
Economies of scale, checkmate mutualists. All right, well, yeah, I think we're actually a little over time here already, so...
A little over time,
yeah, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us for this hour.
Thanks a lot for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been real fun.
Can I put in a plug for C4SS.org? That's the group I write for.
Definitely. Yeah, oh, you guys, check it out.
So you got C4SS.org, Center for a Stateless Society, correct?
Yep, we're market anarchists.
Yeah, the Reddits we post around will get linked there fairly frequently too, but it's a good place to check out.
Market anarchists with an assorted smattering of anarcho-capitalists, anarcho-communists, and Georgists kind of living things out.
So, excellent. Yeah. It's a great site. Check it out. Check out James Carson. I'm going to... take us out.
Kevin Carson. You said James.
Sorry. I'm thinking of James Carlin. We have it. There's another one of our own. I'm sorry about that, Kevin. So it's Saturday for us, but it should be a little after 2300 hours Eastern Standard Time and 2000 Pacific. So keep Obama in president. You know, he gave us a phone. He's going to technocratic management. You too can choose to decline to state as we continue to feel all the feels on either declinefm.com or decline to state on iTunes. I would like to remind you that Decline to State is still brought to you free of charge, as well as paid advertisement free. We hope to soon have a Bitcoin donation link for those interested in helping to keep our servers running, the website developing, and the show going. A big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, our listeners, and of course Kevin Carson for joining us with a very thoughtful discussion. Decline to State is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. Remember, when asked, always decline to state. This is Ron Paul saying, let's anarchy first. We'll figure out right and left later.
This is Eternal, and thanks for tuning in.
We'll be right back.